Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Friends of the Tulsa City County Library and the Foreign Policy Association has a kickoff for their Great Decisions Civic Education Discussion Groups this Sunday afternoon at Central Library. The discussion groups, now over 50 years old in Tulsa, are led by foreign policy specialists and experts and will cover topics like international migration, U.S. and Mexico, cybersecurity, trade with China, nuclear diplomacy, an overview of the Middle East, rising populism in Europe, and the state of the State Department. Over the course of 8 weeks, the discussion group will examine a variety of issues and points of view surrounding a given topic area. Great Decisions begins with a lecture on the resurgence of Russia. While not a topic area this year, U.S.'s relations with the country remains a foremost foreign policy concern. The lecturer will be Robert Donaldson, the Trustees Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Tulsa and a former president of the university who continues to specialize on Russian foreign and security policy. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and directs the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations and is an active lecturer on Russia and world affairs. In fact, he addressed Dallas's Committee on Foreign Relations last evening. He'll kick off the Great Decision Civic Education Discussion Groups Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at Central Library. Bob Donaldson, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's always good to be here, Rich.
You'll be kicking off the Great Decisions Foreign Policy Discussion Program this Sunday, talking about the latest between U.S. and Russia. And I have to ask you, with everything that is going on, and Russia seeming to try to flex their power and interfere in elections, both here and in what increasingly is apparent in Brexit and in various other countries in Europe and Western democracies, and their policy now seemingly of taking care of dissidents abroad with poisonings of former agents and people that have run afoul of the regime. I know that your book on foreign policy has the subtitle of Changing Systems, Enduring Interests. With all of this adventurism, reminiscence of the KGB days, perhaps the title should be Enduring Systems, Changing Interests?
Well, I'll take that under advisement, Rich, but I don't think so, because actually the greatest continuity is between the current Putin regime and the Tsarist diplomacy. And here we're talking, you know, my book's on foreign policy, and so we're talking about not the domestic systems, all of them clearly authoritarian. And yet I argue, and there's plenty of evidence, that Putin's regime, as authoritarian and corrupt as it clearly is less authoritarian than were the Soviets, for sure. And Putin said, you know, anybody who says that he does not regret the fall of the Soviet Union has no heart, but anybody who says it should come back has no brain. So there's no commitment to Marxism-Leninism or ideology. There's no commitment, really, to totalitarianism. Russians can travel. Russians can use the internet and get alternative information. Russians can demonstrate with limits far more than was possible in the Soviet days and in the Tsarist days as well. So yes, the secret police is present, but I would argue, yes, the systems have changed. What I'm really saying is that Russia's great power interests have not changed.
Just as they were playing the great game in the 1840s and 50s and 60s, to the KGB operating abroad, eliminating opponents abroad during the Soviet era, they're doing the same thing today. And this idea of greater Russia, this is a big thing.
It is. And Putin has, I mean, that is the key, really, to his popularity, is his commitment to make Russia great again, to borrow a phrase. And it is, I think, something that the Russian people want and appreciate. I mean, Putin's been in power since January 1 of 2000. That's a long time. And any Western leader, any leader anywhere, would trade with Putin for his popularity ratings, which are still over 60%. But when did they go to their highest? Over 80%. It's when Russia retook Crimea and annexed Crimea. So this idea of making Russia great again, Russia's not going to be pushed around, Russia's going to have a place at the table, that clearly is central to Putin's ideology.
How big a foreign policy issue is that of Russia to reclaim some of the territory it had as the Soviet Union? I saw an article where the leadership of Georgia was complaining and said, you know, Russians are still occupying 20% of our country, Crimea, eastern Ukraine. This is an issue. And there was also a lot of reaction to the Ukrainian Orthodox Church splitting off from the Russian Orthodox Church. And that came from the Russian side because this was a symbol that we're all one.
Yes. And Russia, Putin in particular, has said, in effect, Ukraine's not a separate country. The very founding of Rus, the origin of the Russian Empire, was in Kiev. Vladimir, interesting similarity of names, baptized there. And so the idea of the unity of the church and the unity of the Ukrainian and Russian people is central. But that, of course, was the paradox that led to the Crimea crisis, because Khrushchev, in a moment of maybe less than sober reflection and without any approval from the constitutional authorities, yes, the Soviet Union did have some, switched Crimea's position in the Federation from that of the Russian Republic to the Ukrainian Republic. It made no difference at the time, but when the Soviet Union fell apart, it did make a difference. And Crimea is special for Russians because of the blood that was shed in order to get that, but also the fact that most of the people there are Russian, and it is the home of the Black Sea Fleet, Russia's real avenue out into the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, and so forth. Now, the question of are there other parts of the former Soviet Union that Mr. Putin would like to annex? My view is maybe controversial, but I think it's grounded on history. The decision to put the three Baltic states, or their decision to adhere to NATO, I think has ensured their security. Mr. Putin is not about to send Russian troops or little green men or anybody into the Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, because he does not want a war with NATO. And NATO still has far superior conventional and strategic power. As for, I think Crimea is a special case. As for Georgia, the 20% that is occupied, those have been separatist areas in Georgia since 1991. They've never really been ruled by Tbilisi in all that period, and there are Russian peacekeepers there in South Ossetia and Abkhazia who were there under agreement that was made back in the 1990s between Russia and Georgia. I think the real issue for Ukraine and Georgia was when both of those were under leaderships that said they wanted to join NATO, and that was Mr. Putin's red line, if you will. He does not want, they see these as their sphere of influence, just as the United States sees the Western Hemisphere as its sphere of influence. And their argument is that these parts of the former Soviet Union, the Baltics are gone, but these parts of the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, shouldn't be part of a hostile military alliance.
Now, while you said that the protections of NATO would extend to the Baltic, what we're seeing is a lot of Russian covert foreign policy designed to undermine NATO, seemingly, do you think?
Well, obviously, the old games, spy versus spy, Cold War games, still go on. Both sides clearly still engage in espionage and subversion and so forth. But there is a world of difference between what was the Cold War competition and what is the competition between NATO and Russia now. NATO is, as I said before, far superior in strength. The Russians would clearly like to divide NATO nations. Nothing pleases them more than to hear that President Trump would like to take the United States out of NATO. They clearly, in a variety of ways, want to exacerbate splits within NATO. I mean, and we clearly also still do a good bit in our own way to spy on the Russians and to interfere in their domestic politics as they have in ours. That's going to go on.
Mm. So you've brought up President Trump. And of course, this is the million-dollar question everybody wants to know. What is the relationship between the president and the Russian regime?
The Russian regime or Mr. Putin?
Well, that's,
and that's really...
You think that's a separate question?
I think it is a separate question. And this is really, it's how I began my lecture in talking about how American presidents from the time of Franklin Roosevelt on have sort of idealized that, oh, gee, if I have a personal relationship with the leader of Russia, that that's somehow going to make a big difference in our relationships. And so Trump said, oh, I can get along with Putin. First, he said he knew him. Then he said he didn't know him. Clearly, Mr. Trump has had business interests that he's been pursuing in Russia. Russians have been buying Mr. Trump's real estate for a long, long time. And at critical times when he was in bankruptcy and needing some good customers. And so there's a lot of question about the people around Putin. And so there's that side of it. And then there's the other side, which is go back to Russian interests, that idea in my subtitle. And there, I think what Mr. Trump has said, quite apart from the question of what kind of hold Putin has on him, what Trump said from the beginning was, we should try to get along better with Russia. And I totally subscribe to that. The problem is, and the Russians, that's why they were applauding in the Duma when he was elected, was here was somebody who was going to try to listen to Russia and maybe make some joint projects that would serve interests of both countries. Obama, his people had more or less shut down after the failure of the reset and the return of Putin to the presidency.
Yeah, and the invasion of Crimea.
Well, yeah, and that there again, I mean, I think in terms of Mr. Trump said something he never should have said as a candidate, and that was, well, you know, what's wrong with Russia having Crimea? Well, there's a lot wrong with it. I said earlier they have a historical claim. They have this great affinity. But on the other hand, it's clearly illegitimate what they did. They violated international law. They violated treaties. But I draw a parallel, and actually the U.S. State Department drew the parallel after the Helsinki summit between what was the status of the Baltic states, those three I mentioned earlier, from the time that they were annexed into the Soviet Union at the closing days of the Second World War until they gained their independence in 1991. They were always recognized in the United States and in Britain and other countries as independent free governments. We never acknowledged the legitimacy of that annexation. And that's, I think, where that was the so-called Wells Declaration after an American diplomat. And that's really what the situation ought to be. Not to say, oh, what's wrong with them having Crimea, but to say, look, they have it. There clearly is an enormous military risk to try to undo that by force of arms. And so let's recognize, let's say it's illegitimate, let's never recognize Crimea as part of Russia, and maybe 20 years from now, there'll be a movement in Crimea to say, we hate these Russians, they're starving us, or something like that. It's not really for us to make those kinds of changes by force.
My guest today is Robert Donaldson. He's the Trustees Professor of Political Science Emeritus at the University of Tulsa and a specialist on Russia. And he'll kick off the Great Decisions Foreign Policy Discussion Program at the Tulsa City County Library, speaking this Sunday at 2:30 at Central Library's Aronson Auditorium. And people will be able to hear him talk about U.S.-Russian relations and also pick groups that they'll have foreign policy discussions over the next month or so within the Great Decisions program. I want to ask you your reaction to the Helsinki summit. This is still an ongoing topic of interest in Congress. The fact that the discussions between Putin and Trump have been kept absolutely secret, not only from Congress, but from members of the own administration, even top members of the administration. The interpreter is the only one besides President Trump that knows the substance of these talks.
And the interpreter was required to give her notes over to Mr. Trump and has been told she's not to talk about what she heard.
How unusual is this?
It's very unusual. Michael McFaul, who was Obama's ambassador, his specialist on the National Security Council on Russia, and then his ambassador to Russia, sat in on all of Obama's meetings, not only with Putin, but with Medvedev as well, and said it's totally out of the norm for a president to engage in such secrecy. And obviously what it does is it magnifies suspicion about what kinds of ties does Mr. Putin have a hold on Trump or whatever. This Helsinki summit goes back to that dilemma I was talking about before, where there were certain interests that clearly should be discussed in Syria, the issue of Crimea, relations between Russia and NATO, counterterrorism, counterproliferation, North Korea. There are a lot of things we need to talk about. The American president and the Russian president had not met for 9 years face-to-face, so it was very important to have the summit. And I use in my talk, I use a quote from what a man I consider to be the prime foreign policy expert in Russia, a man named Fyodor Lukyanov, who said, in effect, this was all set up to be a summit with results because they talked about those issues. But, he said, Trump really blew it in that press conference when he seemed to, and did there, and then walked it back later, agree that Mr. Putin's estimate of Russian election interference was it trumped his, to use the word, his own intelligence services. In other words, he started the debate in the United States about the whole issue of whether his ties to Putin were clouding his judgment. And, you know, the whole thing got to be, and in the press conference, he was talking about Hillary's emails and this thing and that thing. And who was talking about substance and who was talking about what was actually discussed, strategic nuclear issues, the INF treaty, Syria, and so forth? It was Putin. He said, this is what we talked about. Mr. Trump didn't talk about any of that. He put the focus entirely on the question of election interference. And obviously, I mean, that's what led late Senator John McCain to say that this was a sellout. John Brennan, the former CIA director, said it's traitorous. It's a pretty strong language. Trump brought that on himself, whereas if he had not done that and they had had a summit and talked about those things, I think that would have been a step forward.
Did that derail the whole conversations between the leaders in private?
I think, well, we don't know what was said in private, but it derailed the summit. Oddly enough, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, when he was asked right after the summit and before the press conference, how was the summit? He said, it was better than super. In other words, you know, there were things there, and various proposals were discussed and so forth. All of this laid out in the Russian press. Our press and our president and our administration had to focus on walking back from Mr. Trump's error to talk as though somehow Mr. Putin's word on election interference was superior to the word of the combined U.S. intelligence agencies who had the goods, and Mueller already had the indictments on the Russians who did interfere, and to resist that was clearly to arouse suspicion.
I want to ask you about an issue that has come up time and time again, the Magnitsky Act, which is sanctions put against top oligarchs in the Russian regime for the poisoning of this Magnitsky. He was a Russian dissident.
Magnitsky was the lawyer for Bill Browder, the big investor, and he died in prison after being maltreated.
Right. Okay. So he, and in response, Bill Browder, the American businessman, got these sanctions passed against top oligarchs. And you hear a lot of times that a lot of the focus of what Russia's doing vis-a-vis the U.S.-Russia relationship beyond the traditional issues is to get these sanctions lifted. How important is that to the Russians?
The Russians are, their economy is clearly suffering because of the sanctions. Mr. Putin, when they were first put on, said, oh, it's not going to bother us at all. It bothers them a great deal. And that was certainly one of their hopes, was that the Trump administration, not right away, but that they would move forward on a number of fronts. Rich, there are several layers of sanctions here. There are the sanctions under the Magnitsky Act, but we also put on sanctions, we and the Europeans, after the seizure of Crimea. We put on sanctions after the attack in Salisbury on the Skripals, the poisoning. That was a violation of U.S. legislation about chemical weapons attacks. And Mr. Trump got very upset because his administration, the State Department, the National Security Council, the Defense Department, which have been much, their instincts have been to be much tougher on Russia than Trump's own instincts, and they talked him into expelling 60 Russian diplomats, as well as to impose further sanctions on banks, companies, and individuals. And he looked around, and the Europeans weren't doing it. Even Britain, where the attempted poisoning took place, didn't do that much. And so those layers of sanctions, clearly the Russians would like them taken off. Some of them are unilateral, but some of them really are multilateral and really have to be the subject of three-way negotiation between us, the Europeans, and the Russians.
And I've always heard that a lot of these sanctions are geared towards the wealth of the oligarchs surrounding Putin and Putin himself, his own personal wealth. Does that make a difference?
Well, it does. And it's not just the wealth. It's also their ability to travel, their ability. I mean, a bunch of these oligarchs have their kids in private school. They own real estate in Mr. Trump's buildings in New York and Florida and various other places. I mean, it restricts their ability to live the kind of lifestyle that their multi-billions they think should entitle them. Mr. Putin's wealth is a subject of great controversy. Bill Browder, the businessman we talked about before, claims that Putin has more than $40 billion salted away. I don't know what he's going to do with it, because he's able, obviously, to live like a czar with all the ultimate housing that he has and the yachts and anything else he wants to enjoy. But they're clearly, the people around Putin are being squeezed hard. And the most recent example is this man, Oleg Deripaska, who's very close to Putin, who was involved with Paul Manafort and is thought to be a particularly shadowy figure. And there you had a kind of an interesting case recently where the Treasury Department eased up on the sanctions on his companies, and members of the Senate thought that that was really going too far. So in a sense, you have kind of the traditional foreign policy establishment, both in the administration and in the Congress, that want to be tougher on Russia. And you have Mr. Trump, who for some reason wants to ease up on some of these things and yet is not able to do it. And frankly, the Russians did interfere in the election. They helped Trump get elected, and they probably have buyer's remorse.
My guest today is Robert Donaldson. He is a specialist on Russia, the former trustees professor of political science. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Tulsa, and he'll kick off the Great Decisions Foreign Policy Discussion Program at the Tulsa City County Library. So what you're talking about is a foreign policy establishment in the United States that is not in sync with the president.
That's right. And
you keep seeing these stories of where the White House says one thing and the State Department, the Defense Department, even the Treasury Department in economic matters says something different.
And it goes beyond that, too. And I'm not going to get into the business about fake news, but the media also have tended to cling to the old stereotypes. I mean, the notion that any time some Russian dies a mysterious death, that Mr. Putin ordered that. Now, frankly, there are two cases, and both former KGB agents, where they were revenge cases, and Putin probably gave the go-ahead for it. The Litvinenko poisoning some years back in London, and the Skripal attack in Salisbury. I was in Salisbury a couple of weeks ago, by the way. You may remember that the Russian story was that those two Russians who were found there on the surveillance cameras were just tourists, and that lots of Russians like to go to Salisbury to see the cathedral. I went to the cathedral a couple of weeks ago. I didn't see any Russians at all. No, clearly, in those cases, Putin took revenge on defectors and ex-spies. The idea that he kills journalists right and left, journalists are killed, and they're killed mysteriously, but not always at the order of Putin. A lot of the trouble comes from this guy Kadyrov, who runs Chechnya, who is a pretty bloodthirsty guy. So we need to be a little more careful in what we say and the kinds of conclusions we draw. And I think sometimes the media get a little sloppy.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about Great Decisions. Great Decisions coming up Sunday. You'll be speaking a bit about Russia-U.S. relations, but also throwing in items about the topics this year, which include migration issues, U.S.-Mexico relations, cybersecurity. Obviously, that there's some Russia issues there. Trade with China, nuclear diplomacy, obviously issues with Russia there. Overview of the Middle East, obviously issues with Russia there. And the rising populism in Europe, Russia has an influence there. If we believe some of the accounts of how they're manipulating media in Europe, and the state of the State Department. These are the topics this year. How does Great Decisions work? You've led some of these groups. You have a topic, and over a course of a few weeks, you have a series of discussions about
that topic. That's right. I have led some of the discussions when there are eight topics for the year that the Foreign Policy Association has laid out. There are videos and readings that people have. Sometimes there are discussion leaders, as I've done. There really isn't one on U.S.-Russia relations this year. The eight topics are otherwise, but you've done a great job of showing how the Russian policy and the great power urges from Russia have had global impact on migration, populism, not U.S.-Mexico, but so I will talk about some of those other things. And people sign up for discussion groups that they'll commit to for 8 weeks of discussion of some very interesting topics.
And they meet at various different times. You choose a topic, and then As a group leader, what do you provide to the people within your group, and how does the discussion go?
Well, the group leaders are given the background reading, and and we all watch the video together. And what I try to do, and I'm sure other leaders do as well, is to provide some additional perspective and then lead a discussion. And the idea here really is for the participants to kind of weigh pros and cons of various policy options that the United States faces, or dilemmas we face, and really to kind of just express themselves, not to come to a consensus or anything like that, but a chance really to understand better and to voice their questions and concerns.
Do the participants stay in one group for the whole 8 weeks?
That's the idea. Yeah.
So you move from topic to topic within that general...
You're in the same location, the same time of the week, and you are with the same group of people for that whole 8 weeks.
So you've been in some of these discussion groups. So can you talk a little bit about how the discussion flows? You get a lot of interesting ideas that come in with one of these sessions?
Oh, yes. I love it because when I was teaching at TU, the programs that brought adult students into the classrooms, I think, these are people who are clearly eager to learn and have opinions and have experience with the world. And I find the discussions very stimulating. And in fact, I do my share of learning as well from the group discussions.
Yeah. And again, the kickoff is this Sunday at 2:30. Bob will be giving a talk on U.S.-Russian relations, again, wheeling in some of the areas. And I guess people sign up for groups that day?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Just one last question. As there's a question over whether Congress is going to try to subpoena the interpreter for the Helsinki summit. These enduring questions about what the role between the president and Russian efforts to meddle in the election and efforts by members of his presidential campaign to meddle in the election and the relationship between him and Putin. What do you think the outcome is going to be at this point? I mean, I assume you're just waiting to see what Robert Mueller comes up with in the report.
You're right. Yeah, it's and I've read a lot. And I have my own suspicions. For me, the question has been primarily follow the money. And there's a lot of trails there. Southern District of New York, the attorney there is a U.S. attorney, is pursuing that line. Mueller is pursuing the line of the election interference, has already come out with some detailed indictments of Russians, both intelligence operatives and a private firm of internet research that's tied to Putin. And so there's a lot that's here, but there are still a lot of missing pieces. And the Mueller report, I think, will be critical in really trying to form some judgments about how far this went.
All right. Robert Donaldson, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Robert Donaldson is the Trustees Professor of Political Science Emeritus at the University of Tulsa and a specialist on Russian foreign and security policy. He'll be addressing the Great Decisions Civic Education Discussion Group's kickoff this Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at Central Library. The 8-week discussion groups can also form at that time. For more information on the event, visit tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.